Today on The Ballot for Governor, you're looking at the biggest field of candidates the state's had in decades. Here are some of the big promises those candidates for governor have made this season.
I'm going to gut the Board of Education.
We need to increase the gas tax. We're driving more miles. We're more fuel efficient. Two good things, but bad put together.
As your governor, I would tell you that we would repeal Common Core and the standardized testing.
But all those plans will be really hard, if not impossible, to pull off as governor. Because it turns out, if you're governor of New Hampshire, you've been handed a pretty raw deal, at least compared to the other 49. Jeff Bolster teaches American history at UNH.
It's not one of the weakest governorships. It is the weakest governorship. No qualification is in order. I mean, we are one of only two states in the nation, New Hampshire, that has a two-year term of governor. The other is Vermont.
So that's the first reason the governorship of New Hampshire is weak, such a short term. Almost everybody else gets 4 years for starters. Let's lay out the other reasons now. Reason number two, and pay attention because this one is huge.
We are the only state in the nation that has this executive council, these five politicians who many voters don't really know about, who have extraordinary power on the governor.
The executive council. Five elected Democrats and Republicans who the governor needs approval from to pretty much do anything. Appoint officials, pardons, any contracts over $10,000. Think about that. A governor can't even appoint her own cabinet.
The governor walks around in the shadow of this.
Spend any time around either Kelly Ayotte or Maggie Hassan, and you'll hear repeated assurances that while it may be election season, they remain wholly dedicated to serving New Hampshire.
I'm really focusing on, you know, my work that I need to do for people in New Hampshire.
My first priority is being governor of the state of New Hampshire.
Take a look at either's fundraising books, however, and you can find plenty of proof that both are also focusing further afield.
California or Texas or Florida, New York.
Joint fundraising committees are a relatively easy way for candidates to cast a wider net for cash. Dave Leventhal is with the Center for Public Integrity. He says Senate candidates from small states like New Hampshire can end up getting upwards of 90% of their campaign donations from non-constituents, and joint fundraising committees let big donors sprinkle money into multiple raises with a single contribution.
You can have somebody walk in the door, write a big check, get out their credit card, and put a much larger dollar figure on the bottom line than you would be able to if you were just individually giving to a candidate or a political committee.
That's because in joint fundraising, candidates act collectively. They share donor lists, hold events, and solicit by mail together.
One way that Colin Van Ostern highlights his experience in the private sector is in his TV ads. A recent one opens with Van Ostern lifting boxes, presumably full of yogurt, into a Stonyfield truck.
I'm Colin Van Ostern, and I learned a lot as a business leader at Stonyfield Yogurt, like how to keep families healthy.
Van Ostern is then seen riding shotgun in the Stonyfield truck as a voiceover outlines his plans for New Hampshire. He's pictured speaking to men in jeans and hard hats and women in pink Planned Parenthood shirts, and all of them are eating out of cups of yogurt. In fact, every single shot in the 30-second ad features Stonyfield in some way. It's been 3 years since Van Ostern actually worked at Stonyfield, but ads like this make it clear he sees his time there as a key item on his resume as he seeks the governor's office. Here he is telling voters as much at a campaign stop this summer.
By the time I was 35 years old, I was responsible for $100 million worth of business a year at Stonyfield. And here's what I learned.
Van Ostern started at Stonyfield in 2011. At the time, the 32-year-old was already well into a career in politics. He had worked on the campaigns of Democrats Gene Shaheen, John Edwards, John Kerry, and Annie Custer. But in 2007, Van Ostern enrolled in Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business in an apparent move to take a break from politics.
This is All Things Considered on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Peter Biello. Candidates for New Hampshire governor recently reported how much money they raised for their campaigns. For years, a loophole in state law has allowed political donors to get around limits on how much they can give. This year, it has helped one candidate in particular, Republican Ted Gatzis. NHPR's digital reporter Brian Walston has studied the reports, and he's here to tell us what they say about this year's governor's race. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Peter.
So, Brian, start off by quickly explaining this loophole in New Hampshire's campaign finance laws.
Well, they call it the LLC loophole after limited liability companies, which are corporate entities that are set up to protect the personal assets of the owner. The loophole dates back to 1999. That's when a federal judge ruled it was unconstitutional to prohibit corporations from making political donations in state elections. The consequence is that some individuals, for legitimate purposes in most cases, set up a lot of these LLCs. And there's nothing in the law that stops them from making donations in the name of each one. Now, legally, each LLC can give no more than $7,000. That's the same limit that applies to you and me and everyone else. But if someone has set up, say, 10 of these things and gave the maximum amount of money in the name of each one, they can contribute as much as $70,000 to a candidate, which clearly is a lot more than the giving limit that normally applies to an individual donor.
So it's been around for a while. Do both parties take advantage of this?
For reasons that aren't entirely clear, maybe because the party has such a reputation as pro-business, Republican candidates have received the overwhelming majority of LLC money spent on governor's races. I mean, since 2000, a little more than $1 million in contributions to governor candidates came from LLCs, and 90% of that went to Republicans. This year, the Republicans have taken in 10 times the amount the Democrats have.
And you report that Manchester Mayor Ted Gatsis has been the big beneficiary this year.
Right. More than $260,000, over a quarter of the $1 million that Gatsis has raised so far, has come from LLCs. And that's the most LLC money ever raised by a candidate for governor in New Hampshire. And it's more than all the other candidates in this race, Republicans and Democrats combined.
Jim Lawrence talks a lot about the company he started in 2003, Lawrence Battelle Incorporated.
My small business started as a consulting firm that made recommendations to the Department of Defense for how they can reduce their government spending.
He describes working side by side with the military and government employees and advising the Department of Defense on, quote, long-term decisions about major weapon systems.
We were actually embedded with the Department of Defense and advising them specifically on some of the decisions they were making for the sustainment tail. In other words, how they were going to actually maintain this fleet of, at the time, 33 aircraft we had worldwide.
But outside of Jim Lawrence's campaign for Congress, we could find little trace of this company. Lawrence Battelle Incorporated does not show up in federal databases, which include all contracts and subcontracts over $25,000. We searched from 2003, when the company was founded, through today. NHPR asked why we could find no evidence of Jim Lawrence doing business with the federal government. Lawrence responded, his company was too small to be reported. We asked for documentation of his firm's work, and Lawrence replied,
well, I could send you evidence of it, but I probably wouldn't.
Follow-up emails from NHPR seeking details on the company's record have gone unanswered. Lawrence says he left the company in 2014, but claims the business continues to operate under other leadership.
I actually stepped away from the active management of that firm. That firm is still continuing to do some work.
But according to New Hampshire Secretary of State's website, Lawrence Battelle Incorporated was dissolved twice in the last 3 years after failing to submit a required annual report to the state. And the company has not been reinstated. The candidate himself is the last registered agent. The only other agent ever listed is Jen Battelle, his current campaign staffer. What one does find when researching Lawrence Battelle Incorporated is a lawsuit the company brought in 2012 against the federal government. The suit was brought by Jen Battelle, now Lawrence's campaign staffer, then a business partner. The company claimed the Air Force unfairly eliminated it from a bid for contracts. Lawrence Battelle sought over $3.5 million in damages. The court dismissed the case. The judge's order describes the company's lack of fitness for the job. It includes the following quote, no performance record is identifiable, or the offeror's performance record is so limited that no confidence assessment rating can be reasonably assigned. According to public records, Lawrence Battelle Incorporated was evicted from its Nashua office in 2013. So who is currently running Lawrence Battelle today, and what work is it doing?
You'd have to contact Lawrence Battelle for that information.
The company has no website, and NHPR's emails to Jen Battelle have not been returned for 2 weeks. For NHPR News, I'm...
At first, it was fresh, new.
We have two candidates at tonight's debate, and they are Republican Frank Ginta and Democratic Congresswoman Carol Shea Porter.
Then, 2 years later, a political reboot.
They are incumbent Republican Frank Ginta and Democrat Carol Shea Porter.
By 2014, it was like, okay, the rubber match.
The incumbent Democratic Congresswoman Carol Shea Porter, her Republican challenger former Congressman Frank Ginta. Now, let's be honest, there's a history between these two candidates.
Yeah, there sure is. And time hasn't exactly brought them any closer. When they meet face to face, it's not hard to find snippy exchanges, including this from earlier in the week.
Wow. Well, you didn't get six bills signed, but we'll leave that aside. The reality is...
Andy Smith is a political science professor at the University of New Hampshire.
After three nasty campaigns already and going into a fourth, I think we have candidates that don't like each other very much, probably don't respect each other very much.
Friendships aside, Shea Porter and Ginta's alternating success seems to be less tied to their political beliefs. Neither candidate strays very much from their party line. Instead, the revolving door seems more a result of what's happening higher up the ticket at the national level. Shea Porter has prevailed in presidential election years, while Ginta's two victories came during midterm elections, when Democratic turnout is typically lower. Recent polls show a similar trend shaping up in 2016, with Shea Porter holding a double-digit lead. A campaign finance scandal is also contributing to Ginta's struggles. Last year, he reached a settlement with federal elections officials over improper campaign donations he got from his parents. But you don't have to spend too much time talking with voters in this seesaw district to detect a sense of exhaustion with both candidates.
Are you tired of seeing the same two names jockey back and forth?
There is some of that, I must say. Maybe it's time for both of them to go away.
That's Dennis Sullivan of Dover. Laura Chapin echoes those feelings.
We need some choices. Obviously, the choices that have been made aren't working out for the state and the country as a whole. So it's a little difficult to imagine that there isn't anybody else out there that could do a better job or at least have some other options.
There is one new wrinkle in the 2016 edition of this race. Sean O'Connor.
So I am Sean O'Connor. I am the independent running for Congress here in the 1st District in New Hampshire.
O'Connor, a Bedford businessman, is self-financing a run after dropping out of the Democratic primary earlier this year. He's running TV ads and also doing some retail politicking, like this stop at a Portsmouth nursing home. The Groundhog Day feel of the race comes up quickly in his stump speech.
And I think that it's crazy that we've had the same two career politicians in D.C. who have gone back and forth and back and forth.
O'Connor, though, will have to overcome a serious lack of name recognition compared to Ginta and Shea Porter. Regardless of who prevails, political analyst Andy Smith says don't be surprised if those two names also pop up in 2018.
They both think they can win it. And if you both think you have a chance, why not?
In this political tug of war, the candidates do seem awfully willing to dust themselves off and try again. For NHPR News, I'm Todd Bookman.
As his son Chris is running for governor, John H. Sununu isn't just playing the role of supportive father. He's also one of his son's most powerful campaign cheerleaders.
We need a Republican governor with a name I like to talk about.
That was at a recent rally for vice presidential candidate Mike Pence in Exeter, where John H. Sununu couldn't pass up the chance to remind the crowd of a name farther down on the ballot.
Look, Chris Sununu's running for governor. You know that. I've often said that shows the quality and power of good breeding stock.
It's been three decades since John H. Sununu held public office, but the Sununu name is still arguably the most prominent brand in New Hampshire Republican politics. Longtime friends say it all started decades ago in their hometown of Salem. John H. Sununu served as chairman of the local planning board in the 1970s. His wife, Nancy, served on the school board. The couple was famous, among other things, for hosting an annual New Year's Day brunch that attracted hundreds. John H. Sununu eventually went on to serve as governor in the 1980s. His oldest son, John E. Sununu, was in the U.S. Senate in the 2000s. Now, Chris Sununu, after a few terms on the executive council, is looking to keep the Sununu legacy going.
To say he grew up in a political family is an understatement.
That's Donna Sitek, a longtime friend of the family who's been there through victory and defeat on the campaign trail.
In a political family, every 2 years you expect somebody's going to be running for something.
And for most of Chris Sununu's childhood, that was the case. By the time he was 12, his dad was on the ballot in one way or another every election day.
Shelburne is a valley town. Population, 372. Mountain ranges hold it north and south, and the Androscoggin River splits across its middle. There are no stores or gas stations, not a single traffic light in Shelburne.
The last dairy cow went out of Shelburne about 10 years ago, and over in the fields over there, you'd see a couple of horses and a donkey. Mm-hmm.
That's lifelong resident Ann Ledger. When I show her the numbers from this year's presidential primary, how Shelburne voted, almost identical to the state as a whole, she doesn't seem surprised. She can see a lot of similarities between the two. The state, for example, has been grappling with the controversial power line project Northern Pass for years. In Shelburne, Ledger says, things aren't much different.
The major issue in the last few years has been the rights of way. And every time somebody wants to come through, they want to come through here because we're one of the only east-west valleys available.
When Ledger grew up here in the 1940s, Shelburne was a place of farms and people of the land, as she calls them. Not anymore. A shift she suspects might be found in the state at large.
You know, it used to be that we would vote 100% Republican. I don't know what the figures are, but there are a lot more Democrats voting in Shelburne now.
Joe Carpenter at the town hall has those numbers.
90 Republicans and 68 Democrats. However, look at the undeclareds. 162.
As with the rest of the state, it's those independent voters who increasingly have the biggest say at the ballot box. But Carpenter also has the
first figures. Let's get a quick snapshot of the New Hampshire economy.
We're tied for the lowest unemployment rate in the country. Personal income's growing. We've added about 30,000 jobs.
This is Russ Tebow, an economist with the Laconia-based firm Applied Economic Research.
Economic indicators are up, so really we've done quite well. The state's economy has done quite well.
Tebow says there are a couple of reasons for New Hampshire's economic strength during the past few years. For starters, there's a good mix of jobs. Healthcare, education, manufacturing, and hospitality. All our eggs aren't in, say, a steel or energy basket. And B, we are little fish in the much bigger ocean that is the national economy. A national economy that's been doing relatively well.
It's a case of a rising tide lifting all ships, including New Hampshire.
And so, with lots of good data to throw around, it's no surprise that Governor Maggie Hassan, who sat in the corner office for the past 4 years, is making economic issues a centerpiece of her campaign for Senate.
As you know, in my first term, I doubled and made permanent with the legislature our R&D tax credit. My economic plan calls for small business tax cuts and expanding the federal R&D tax credit as well.
Those research and development tax credits are just one of a number of business-friendly policies Hassan regularly brings up on the trail. She's also running TV ads, boasting of her handling of the state budget.
Maggie Hassan's approach to innovation and business development.
Controlling spending, smart investments in education.
And Hassan's balanced budget was a bipartisan compromise the Telegraph said worked.
It doesn't work.
That's State Senate President Chuck Morse.
You can't veto it and then come back and take credit for it. It was a veto override in September. That's what it was.
Morse, a Republican from Salem, helped craft the state's two-year spending plan. When it landed on her desk, Hassan vetoed it, complaining about the cuts to business taxes. 3 months later, she signed off on a little-changed budget. So Morse is not too keen on her now trying to take credit.
If that's what she's going to run on, she's wrong. And I certainly have taken the time to point that out to the public because she didn't support this budget, and she certainly didn't implement it properly.
Hassan's opponent, Republican incumbent Kelly Ayotte, also brings up that veto during debates. Another challenge to Hassan's economic record is that while the state overall has been performing well, there are still regions that...
Listen to Kelly Ayotte on the campaign trail these days, and at times her message can sound like a hymn to bipartisanship.
I know we're not going to get anything done if we don't find common ground, and I will look to be a bridge builder, and I have good relationships and respect within my own party, but I have also built relationships across the aisle that I think will be important no matter what happens in November.
That's a far cry from Ayotte's message 6 years ago when she campaigned as a conservative bent on checking the policies of President Obama. Back then, Ayotte ran as a climate change skeptic. Now she sees addressing the issue as fundamental to New Hampshire's future.
You know, I do believe that climate change is a very important issue. So I've supported, for example, the Clean Power Plan. And so this is an area where I hope to be really leading bipartisan efforts.
Ayotte was the first Republican in Congress to back the president's plan to reduce carbon emissions, and she later fought GOP efforts to block it. According to Jamie French of the Northland Forest Company, who's appeared in an Ayotte campaign ad, when it comes to the environment and conservation, Kellyanne.
When he was a kid, politics shaped Jay Flanders' life. His dad was state treasurer, so after school was spent running around the halls of the state house. As an adult, Jay Flanders is a guy who actually shapes politics. He's not the guy that likes to be out front. He prefers to do his business back in the proverbial smoke-filled room.
First of all, there's no smoking in the state house, so there's no smoke-filled rooms. Not anymore.
Flanders was Senate Chief of Staff for the Republican majority. He's consulted on campaigns, and he's agreed to meet me at this coffee shop in Concord to talk about a part of politics that chances are doesn't come up at your dinner table. The intricate, obscure process of political redistricting. Or the story of how Republicans gerrymandered New Hampshire's Senate map. It's okay. We can say it. Gerrymandering. Flanders says it.
Gerrymandering may be distasteful. In the more extreme cases, it is hardcore bare-knuckle politics. But everyone agreed the map was going to change.
So let's set the scene. 2010. Tea Party outrage helps Republicans sweep the New Hampshire State House. One of the starkest political flips any state makes. Republicans come out of that with the biggest state house majority they've had in a generation.
A new era of government in Concord as new members of the House and Senate were sworn into office.
That was also the year of the census, when a state gets new numbers about who and how many people it has and redraws its political map to reflect those shifts. And in New Hampshire, it's the party in power that holds the pen. Translation, a big political opportunity for the new Republican majority. They got to draw fresh maps for the House, the Senate, and the Executive Council. The Senate map was Flanders' job.
Republican senators wanted a map that would continue to elect Republican senators.
And this is not a moment that attracts protests on the State House lawn, but this may be the most important thing Republicans get to do that term, drawing the political map that'll be in play for the next decade. So Flanders and his team get to work.
At Spalding High School, there's a class called the History of American Presidents. It seemed like the perfect place to get some insight on the race to become America's future president. So this morning, I stopped by with a simple assignment for the students. Say your name and tell me what you think of how the 2016 election has played out.
Aries Ellsworth, and it's definitely going to make history. This will definitely be in probably one of the like top 10 worst elections ever.
Dominic Lindsay, I think what they'll remember about this election is that they'll probably be wondering what the hell we were thinking when the American people were able to nominate such strange candidates.
Carter King. I think this election is eye-opening for a lot of people in the United States because if Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are running for president, then more people are going to think that they're going to be able to run for president in the future years.
You think that's a good thing?
I think it's a good and bad thing.
At 27 years old, Barbara Aguayo's seen a lot. When she was 7, she, her mom, and 5 brothers and sisters left home in the middle of the night to get away from their abusive father. They landed on the streets of Manchester, living homeless for a while. As the years went on, things didn't get much better. An abusive partner, rough group of friends, her education stopped in high school. And all that shapes how she walks through the world, what she expects from life.
It gives me a lot of trust issues. I'm actually pretty much a hardball.
Aguayo wants to give her 2 sons a safer, happier life than she had here on Manchester's East Side. But she says this can be a rough place to raise kids.
The East Side is not a very good neighborhood. This last year, I think it was right at the end of the school year, we were actually playing in the park right across the street, and we didn't realize, but there were shootings happening right there on the corner on the other side of the park, and our kids are playing.
Aguayo lives in Ward 5, one of the poorest neighborhoods in Manchester. I met her while she was volunteering at the Beach Street Elementary School, which both her sons attend. And here at Beach Street, 95% of the kids qualify for free or reduced lunch. The median income level for parents is around $25,000. That's less than half of Manchester's. A lot of kids live in households where English isn't the main language. A lot of immigrants and refugees live here. And those factors, being poor, less likely to speak English, less education, turn out to be the recipe for low voter turnout, research shows. Ward 5 has one of the lowest turnout rates in New Hampshire. Two-thirds of the people here don't vote, including Barbara Aguayo.
Voting, I do not do. Just like my mom, we do not vote. I deal with a lot more than dealing with who's running my country.
What she's dealing with are raising her kids and just surviving. And she doesn't see politics playing any role in that. And Aguayo says her main reason for not voting comes back to those trust issues.
A lot of times presidents say, oh, I'm going to do this for you. And once they're in office, they're not doing it. Because honestly, it doesn't really matter who runs our country. If we vote, it really doesn't matter at the end of the day what our vote says. They just kind of take our opinion and ride with it. It's really not up to us who's going to be in office and who's not.
Jessica Whiting lives on Grove Street here in Ward 5.
You know, my friends are judging me. Are you going to vote? Well, no, I'm not.
Whiting's another stay-at-home mom who volunteers at the Beach Street School.
Welcome back to NHPR's election night coverage. We're going to go back now to NHPR's senior political reporter Josh Rogers. He is at Republican U.S. Senator Kelly Ayotte's campaign headquarters in Concord. And Josh, just remind us how important this U.S. Senate race here in the Granite State is for the national Senate race.
Well, it's one of a handful that people believe could decide the balance of power in the United States Senate, and that's one reason it's attracted such a flood of outside spending. You know, we'll be north of 100, maybe 130 million by the time that's tallied, and, you know, that translates to $170 a vote, approximately, which is really amazing. And, you know, it's featuring two up-and-comers within their parties and two popular politicians.
Well, and speaking of the presidential campaign, Josh, we've been...
After Tuesday's elections, Newfields, New Hampshire is entitled to a little bit of bragging. Two of the town's 1,700 residents now hold the highest titles in the state. Both Senator-elect Maggie Hassan and Governor-elect Chris Sununu call Newfields home. NHPR's Todd Bookman made a visit to what could be the state's new seat of power.
Newfields doesn't have much, but what it does have seems to work just fine. That includes the little 150-year-old country store on Main Street.
Our specialty here is we make our homemade bread, our sandwiches, lunchtime. We make homemade rolls, our baked goods, and of course the coffee.
Linda Parsons has worked behind the counter here for more than 10 years. She knows all the regulars, who happen to include Maggie Hassan and Chris Sununu.
We treat them with respect as governor, executive counselor, but soon to be U.S. senator and governor, yet they're real people too.
Parsons jokes that Newfields is the center of the political universe right now, and that's not just because their chili is pretty good. Leroy Legg and his wife Charlotte own the store. He says it's no surprise that the Hassans and Sununus would choose to live here. Newfields is a quintessential New England town. Lots of old homes dot Main Street. Nobody is too flashy. Everybody mostly friendly.
I call it Norman Rockwellville. It's just wonderful. It's a community. It's a very close community, and everybody participates.
Hassan and her family joined the community just last year after living in neighboring Exeter. The Sununus have been here for about a decade. They'll both now be commuting to Washington and Concord, respectively. In fact, most people who live here also work elsewhere, though the town is home to a couple of companies, including Hutchinson, a manufacturer of auto parts, and Co-Ed Sportswear, which in the 1990s was famous for their raunchy line of T-shirts. But if you're thinking this is a sleepy little town, the clerk and tax collector for Newfields, Sue McKinnon, wants you to know otherwise.
Yes, but what we have here in Newfields is we have a Memorial Day celebration with a parade. We have a summer solstice where we have activities and bands. We recently just had a fall celebration. We have our holiday celebration. We have lots of little events like that that bring the community together.
And that community came together to back its local candidates on Tuesday. John Hayden is a lifelong resident and the current town moderator. Despite coming from different political parties, he says both Hassan and Sununu received the most local votes in their respective races.
I don't want to say it's unique, but I think it's definitely a, you know, a good thing to see. You know, people getting outside of their strong political views and looking at the person. So,
and just about everyone in town here does seem to have met them at some point. Allison Bizdafka is a longtime teacher at the elementary school.
Maggie actually spoke at the fifth grade celebration at the end of the year last year. And Chris and his wife, Valerie, have been an integral part of school, so it's pretty awesome.
She doesn't even need to use last names. The next governor and senator are well enough known around Newfields that Maggie and Chris will do just fine.
For NHPR News, I'm Todd Bookman.